Hello and welcome to the PCOS Nutritionist Podcast. If we haven't met yet, then my name is Claire. I'm a registered nutritionist and I also hold a qualification in exercise science. That's my other degree, natural fertility education and functional medicine. And I have PCOS too, so I know how damn frustrating these symptoms can be. But I also know after 10 years or more of trial and error, how good it can be on the other side when most of those symptoms are in remission and I'm no longer without a period for 3 years, right? Like I have ovulated now every month for the last 5 years. I also know what it's like to not have to deal with acne or unexplained weight gain. For the first time in my life, being able to maintain my weight without really thinking about it. And for you, those symptoms might be facial body hair growth or hair loss. Fatigue was another one that I struggled with. And so many other things that people don't talk about, like blood sugar crashes and severe sugar cravings. Or maybe it's feeling like you need to sleep forever to ever feel refreshed. So my philosophy is that PCOS is a condition that is a combination of your genetics and environment not playing nicely together. Now, PCOS is a genetically driven condition, right? We have the genes that predispose us to PCOS, but your genes don't determine your future or don't determine or aren't guaranteed to determine your future. It's really a matter of the environment has to turn those genes on to make them present. So equally though, we can turn those genes off and not get those symptoms. So what I want to find out is what's affecting your, or what's driving your PCOS. So what systems in your body are not functioning optimally that are causing your body to have these symptoms? And there are a few things that the research shows can really drive this. The main one is blood sugar and our hormone insulin, which controls our blood sugar. The next most common is our stress hormones. The third most common is a thyroid condition and then chronic inflammation, or it can be some other causes as well, but those are really the main things. So for me, and when I work with my patients, the most important thing is to find out what's driving that for you, because then we can then have very specific lifestyle changes that are actually going to work. We're no longer just jumping from diet to diet, hoping that something will work, right? We know what the problem is and we can then put together a solution, right? It's like going to your mechanic and, you know, if you went to your mechanic and said, hey, my car's not starting, you know, if they said to you, we'll order a different motor. And you're like, sorry, excuse me? Like, have you even tried turning it on? Have you looked at it? Have you figured out what could be causing it? And they're like, no, we'll just buy a new motor and see if that works. And you're like, hold on, that's a really expensive way to go about fixing my car. You wouldn't accept that, right? You'd go, right, well, figure out what's going wrong. And that's the same thing as we need to do with our PCOS. We need to figure out first what's going wrong before we can put the right plan in place. Otherwise, we're just using a scattergun approach and hoping that something works. And I think this is something that we don't understand or haven't really thought about, is that changing our lifestyle, like slightly tweaking what we eat or maybe how we move or the vitamins and minerals in our body or how much we sleep, can have a dramatic impact on the way that our hormones work. But if we don't know what to focus on, then we're so scattered and we're just trying to do everything, which is just either not achievable or not sustainable. So this is the way that I work with you and helping you understand what are the most important things you should be doing. And that really is only four or five things. It's not changing your entire lifestyle and diet and getting you to cut out every possible food group under the sun or setting up with unrealistic training expectations where you have to exercise 4 hours a day. You don't have to do that and to see success and see results. And actually people that do tend to do those things like cutting out massive food groups or training 4 hours a day often find that their symptoms get worse because they're so tired and so grumpy that they can't stick with any changes. So I help you through my program, the PCOS Protocol, and this is something that's it's not just a PDF we send you. This is a program that I work with you on. So I'm there every week answering questions from you, doing live calls with you, trying to personalize and change things that you have the maximum effect while we understand what's driving this for you and what changes you need to make. So that's a bit about me and a bit about us. And let's get into the topic for today, though, because that is what you are here for. So Tess, thank you so much for coming on and chatting and sharing your story. So nice to have you here. So can you start by, I always do this, but from where you think the beginning of your PCOS journey was?
No worries, Claire. Thanks for having me. I think my journey really actually starts when I was about 8. I have got 2 sisters, 1 older, 1 younger, always ate the same things that they ate. But when I was 8 was the first time that my doctor put me on a diet because I was heavier than them, which is a lot to process when you're 8. And they didn't term it as a diet, but it was, the idea was I had to stay the same weight for 2 years in order to fit more in line with, you know, my BMI and what I should be then. And in hindsight, that's probably the first indication that my body was operating a little bit different to the rest, to my sisters, because really we should all have been relatively similar. We were all relatively active. We all ate, you know, relatively well. And there was, you know, there was no real reason that I should be so different to them. So then moving forward, 13, I get 1 period and then nothing. Which I've never in my entire life had, you know, consecutive periods, even, you know, if you put years apart being consecutive. Sort of 2 years after that, after the dandruff and the cystic acne, which is, it's actually hard to explain cystic acne to people. They're like, oh yeah, you know, you just get a pimple and then it pops and then it goes away. It doesn't. You are aware of every pimple on your face at every waking moment because it aches, it throbs, and it doesn't matter what you do or don't do, you just can't get rid of it. So at 15, they did a diagnosis and they said, yeah, cool, you've got PCOS, which is funny. So this is probably 20 years ago. And so back then they said there was no genetic link, like no. So that's how old this is. And so even though they said it was just coincidence that my older sister had PCOS as well, which is quite interesting. And obviously since then all the research has changed on that.
Yeah.
So 15, went on the pill, which dramatically improved my skin, which was great. I stayed on the pill for about 12 years. And then came off just because I felt like it was time for a change. And then really that's probably when I started to delve properly into what I was doing, saw a naturopath, started to get an idea of what was going on. Because what I would find is every now and again I would just put on weight. Like I would be fine for 6 months and then in like 2 weeks I'd put on 4 or 5 kilos, which if you explain it to someone, like the amount of calories you would have to consume to earn 4 or 5 kilos in 2 weeks is just ridiculous. So and then it would be so hard to get off. It's just ridiculous. And so then that accumulates. And suddenly, you know, you're sort of sitting in. I was lucky. I never really got to an obese level, but, you know, still sitting in the overweight category of your BMI, like it's still not comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also the fact that you are very aware that you don't have any control over this, right? That it's that kind of spiraling out of control of, okay, well, if I can just put on weight so easily and either very, very, very hard to lose or almost impossible, then where is this going to stop? And I think, yeah, that's the really scary part as well.
Right? Yeah, and, you know, you do all the tools that, you know, you think you need to do. And during my life, the only times I've really successfully lost any sort of any amount of weight is significantly under eating, which is not good. Not 1,200 calories is what my toddler should be eating. It's mm-hmm. not what, you know, a grown woman should be eating. So
yeah, and certainly not for life, right? Like not to, no. you know, not to be maintaining weight. And that's what so many of us have had yeah. to do in the past, to just maintain where we are at the moment is ridiculously low.
And I can think back, I've actually found a diary back from 2012 when I used to track what I was doing, and I look at what I was doing, I was like, I don't know how I did that. Mm. I don't know how I did that on 1200 calories. Like it was just ridiculous. And I remember like I'd get to Thursday and I'd be exhausted from all the stuff that I was doing. And I remember being in this cycle where like Monday to Friday, I would probably lose 2 kilos. And then on the weekends, I would put on 2 kilos because I would just have to release and have to go back and, you know, eat some chips or whatever it was. And then I actually remember doing that for years.
And you'd just get into that cycle of berating yourself as well, because you're like, oh my, like you were doing so well. And then it was your, what happened? You don't have any self-control. This is your own fault. This is why you keep putting on weight. Everyone else seems to be able to manage this well. What are you doing? And that's definitely what I was telling myself as well. And really, actually, it's our body being like, I cannot function on what you're giving me. Like, yeah. And it is physiologically driving you to go and find food, and ideally high calorie food, which is what it wants.
Yeah. I remember going on a holiday, I think it was 2015, so I was off the pill then. We went to Bali, and of course, you know, Bali is all rice and everything like that. And I remember, I think I put on like, you know, 5 kilos in 10 days or something. It was something ridiculous. And it was all on my stomach, and you could just see the inflammation and the fluid and all of that. I remember going for a massage and they're like, you're not pregnant, are you? I was like, no, I've just been eating rice in Bali. I guess that's what you do. So it's those sort of things where you know, you go and you try and do what other people are doing, and then you sort of end up not feeling particularly good about yourself.
Yeah, and that's the horrible thing, right? Because you're like, what am I doing so wrong? Like, what is everyone else doing that I'm missing? I remember looking at, I vividly remember this, when I was studying nutrition at university, right? Probably would have been second year or third year maybe, and just looking at the magazine rack at the local supermarket or something like that, and seeing all of these celebrity diets and stuff like that, and just being like, what are they being taught that I'm not? Like, I am going to be a qualified nutritionist next year and I still can't get it right for myself. Like, what do these people know that I don't? It's just, is there some trick? Like, is there something there that everyone else just has, you know, happens to know and I'm missing? Because it's not that weight is really the problem. It's just when it's so unexplained, and so that it's just so frustrating when you're like, I don't know why this is happening, especially that, you know, really rapid gain, or the, you know, really struggling to lose weight. Like, I remember, you know, people in my hall of residence at university as well laughing about the fresher five. So when you're first year university, you're called a fresher. So fresher, and everyone puts on 5 kilos. Majority of people put on like slightly more than that, but then everyone laughing and be like, oh, well, I'll just lose it in the summer and come back. And I'm like, how do you do that? That would be great if that was possible, but I actually don't see that happening. And more often it's actually just compounding year after year. And I think that's the really frustrating part about it, is when it doesn't make any sense compared to, especially when you're living alongside people, like you said, your sisters, where you're like, we are in the same household. We have exactly the same access to food. It's not like I have a personal stash of chocolate in my room that my sisters don't. Like, we have all the same food, same thing. Like, we are living together in a flat or a house sharing situation or a hall of residence. Yep. We're eating the same things. Why is my body reacting so differently, even though I'm probably the healthiest out of all of these people in terms of what I eat and how much I move?
Yeah. So then, yeah, came off the pill, had two random periods, sort of 2014, 2015, can't really tie down why. Mm. And then late 2016, started the assisted fertility journey. If you sort of know yourself, you're like, this is kind of probably going to be the only way that we get pregnant.
Right.
You know, I've had at that stage, I think I was 30 maybe. You know, I've had three ovulations in my entire life. Like I can't just sit around for years and wait for this to happen. And fortunately in Australia, it's reasonably affordable. It's not for everyone, but, you know, I'm lucky to be in a position where financially that was affordable for me. So we started with the Clomid, and I, out of six cycles, I managed to ovulate twice.
Wow.
Yeah, on varying different strengths too, which was bizarre. So, like the first one I did, I ovulated. I was like, oh, okay, I didn't expect that. That was really bizarre. And then the next one I didn't. And then the next one I didn't. And then I found my naturopath put me on some herbs to help sort of clear the testosterone out of my system. And the next one I did.
Right.
And then I didn't again after that. So it's, yeah, it was one of those ones where we could get it to ovulate, but then, yeah, it just didn't
turn into
anything.
And also it's so hard because especially when they'll only give you six cycles, you sort of every cycle that doesn't result in that, you're like, oh, my, another mischance, and must be so, so frustrating going through that process.
And every, like sex should be fun. And the longer you do this, the less fun it gets. And especially if you're like, cool, hubby, yep, let's pick now, let's do it now. And they're like, it's not how it works. And the more pressure that is, the more, you know, that gets more difficult. You know, things that always worked perfectly just stop working under that amount of pressure. Absolutely. And so we did two cycles of the trigger injection. So the injections to build up an egg ready to go, and then the trigger to release the egg. And even that was probably more pressure. And so we ovulated twice from that, but yeah, nothing sort of really came from it. And to be honest, that's when I was like, oh, cool, we can actually get to the point now where we can do IVF, because I sort of always thought, oh, well, that's where we would get to. And so up until then, everything had just been a step. I think the worst thing you can do when you're going through assisted fertility is ride the wave of emotion. That's, you're really just going to go, cool, what's the next step? I'll do the next step. Yep, okay, we've done that. All right, what's the next step after that? Yep, we'll do that step. And then try not to go, oh, this will be the one that works, and then it's everything I've invested into this, because it's exhausting. You can't do that. You can't put that much pressure on yourself to say, oh, this will be the thing that works.
Because you have no control over it, right?
And it's just, you know, it's that level of exhaustion and that emotional, it's not going to help the situation either. So
yeah. So did you almost kind of have to disassociate yourself from that?
Which I'm reasonably good at doing as a person anyway. I'm an accountant by trade, so I can sort of analyze it and then go, okay, this is what we need to do, and then just do that part of it. So it sort of makes it a bit easier for me. And I sort of, even up until then, I was always like, well, this probably won't work. After we did the Clomid, I had a laparoscopy. Then went in and had a look, and the doctor is like, I've never seen such twisted and cystic tubes. And so in my head I was like, well, you know, the tubes might work, but they might not work. So you know, even if we can get it, the eggs, the ovaries to ovulate, you know, it might not really fit down properly, and you know, might not be getting there to the right stage. So
that's really fascinating that talking, because most of the emphasis on PCOS is like cystic ovaries. So fascinating that he was talking about your fallopian tubes there. Of course your brain's going to go, well, if we do IVF, we completely bypass the fallopian tubes when we insert it straight into the uterus. So great outcome, you know, great outcome is being able to bypass that. And I think that I'm quite similar to you. I can easily disassociate myself from something, and that's just the way that my brain works. But I really feel for people that really struggle with that. And I think I'm probably not the best person to give tips on this, and maybe you're not either, Tess, because we're used to the way that our brain works. But maybe I don't know if you are the kind of person that gets a lot more emotionally involved in the situation, maybe talking to a psychologist would be the best person to talk to about techniques to do that, or maybe it's not disassociating yourself, but the way to manage that, or the way to not feel triggered by every single failure, right? Because I think that's the thing, is when it's just such a blow that when you're going through, if you need to, you know, have a similar journey to you, 6 cycles of Clomid plus, I know many patients have then gone on to IUI first, yeah, and then IVF. And so every single cycle is just, and that could easily be, you know, 12 cycles before they get a positive one. So yeah, it's a huge emotional toll to go through. So I think that's quite a good way. And maybe also talking to other people that have gone through it, because those that are similar to you emotionally might be able to give you tools and techniques to help with that process. But one thing I have been told by other patients as well, is what's been really helpful for them is to having some other focus and area that they get joy from in their life, because everything becomes about the treatment, and so much of your emotion and your joy is tied to the outcome of that treatment, which you have no control over. And so often people, you know, have, you know, they're still working, which can be good, but can also be not good if it's really stressful. But having something else that you get joy from in your life, right? So whether that's an interest, a sport, a hobby, or something that you're doing that you can regularly, that you're doing on a weekly or daily basis or a couple of times a week, get a sense of joy from, because a lack of that really compounds the disappointment when you're going through fertility treatment, whether that's fertility treatment or whether that's natural, whether you're just trying on your own before, before going through assisted reproductive treatment. But I've heard from many people that have said the same thing, that really having something else in your life was really helpful for them.
Yeah, and even I, we're lucky, we were really, really good candidates for IVF. I had lots of eggs and really good quality ones. And my husband had super sperm, so put those together, and we're one of those lucky people that had 10 embryos successfully freeze.
Amazing.
which is a ridiculous number. And people are like, oh, you can have 10 babies. I'm like, no, I don't need 10 babies. I'll just start with one and let's just see how that goes. But it wasn't until the first transfer that I went, oh, actually, hang on, this is real. This is starting to scare me, because if this doesn't work, then I'm running out of options. And I want this to be special. I don't want to get to the point where I just go in for a transfer and we're like, oh, well, it might work, it might not. Because up until then, I sort of never really believed that it was going to work. Whereas I'm like, this is the thing that I think is going to work. And if it doesn't, that is really scary. Mm. So luckily, as part of the process in Australia to do IVF, you have to talk to a counsellor. And so I booked another appointment with her and I said, look, this is the bit where I'm starting to get scared, because I don't, yeah, I it's so special. This first one is so special and I want to keep that feeling. And so if it doesn't happen, I don't want to lose that feeling of this process being special. And I was just really lucky that the first one worked. And my son Henry was locked and loaded and not going anywhere. So.
Brilliant. And that's so good. But I think you're right, though, as well, is that when you've been so focused on, okay, well, Clomid doesn't work, then we'll move on to the next step. Whereas once we kind of get to IVF, that is kind of the final step, right?
Running out of next steps.
Yeah.
And there still are, like, for those who do that and it's not working, but there still are things that you can do. Mm. There's a different combination of drugs that they can use to support that. In some cases, I've known people who have changed clinics, and the other clinic has just approached it from a slightly different perspective or used a slightly different combination of drugs that has suited them, and then they've fallen pregnant. So it's just because you don't fall pregnant the first time or the first 5 times, it's sometimes good just to reassess and go, okay, am I getting what I need support-wise out of this? Are they giving me enough options? Are they doing the same thing each time, or are they actually going, okay, well, let's test this, or let's look at that, or let's make sure this is working, And if they're not, then maybe you need to look, if possible, look at another clinic and see if they can support it. I also highly recommend acupuncture. Whether it is all in my head or whether it is actually real, I don't know. But I felt better going and doing that as part of the transfer process.
So there is actually quite a bit of research on acupuncture, whether that's from a natural fertility perspective or from when use in combination in assisted reproductive or IVF or other fertility treatment as well. And so I think it's definitely not, and people said, I think there is enough now to go, this actually has potentially some merit. Maybe there's not quite enough for a, generally they might do really to look at all of the different research. They might do something called a meta-analysis or a systematic review, or the kind of the gold standard is a Cochrane review, and they'll pull together all of the studies and then assess them and say definitively whether, with that combined power of all the studies, can we say yes or no, this does have some effect or not. And there, I don't know of any, but I feel like there's probably quite, not quite enough yet to say definitively. But in, on an individual randomized control trial basis, there have been many that have been in support of acupuncture. So I think there's also, you know, there's amazing benefit from a Chinese perspective. And China is sometimes hard for us that have grown up in Western medicine to understand the Chinese philosophy behind medicine. And it's a very different way of looking at the human body. In Western medicine, we very much look at these silos. So it's like we look at, you know, whether it's silos of organs like your brain versus your ovaries versus your heart versus your lungs, or whether it's individual areas of medicine like gynecology versus endocrinology versus cardiology, right? So whereas Chinese philosophy, Chinese medicine philosophy is quite different to that. So sometimes it's quite hard to wrap your head around how that actually works and how acupuncture could work. But I mean, the fact that it has been used for thousands and thousands of years is a really good sign that if it wasn't working, it probably would have done away with it by now. And yeah, so it can be really helpful for helping people to ovulate again if they haven't been ovulating, but then also great for reducing like inflammation, stress management, those parts as well, which may be really important for those undergoing IVF. So yeah, definitely don't think it was in your head, Tess. I think that there's really some amazing merit behind it.
Yeah, so then Henry was in there. At 6 weeks, we had a little bit of bleeding. So luckily, I was
always a little bit. Just I think the first trimester is just such a it's just a brain. A brain fart, for want of a better word. It's just everything is just your mind is just going right.
But yeah, every possible thing that could happen. It's terrifying. You know, you're saying, well, how can there be, you know, blood coming out and my baby still be fine in there? And he was, and we increased my progesterone support to make sure that he was staying in there. And then after that, didn't have a single issue apart from that. I luckily grow really big babies. but everything else in the pregnancy seemed to go well. It's funny to look at the difference. So I'm pregnant now, 22 weeks, so looking at the difference in the pregnancies and looking back at Henry's, I would wake in the middle of the night starving to death, absolutely starving at 3 or 4 in the morning. And you know, you've only got so much brain function at 3 or 4 in the morning. So I would just grab a banana and eat a banana and go back to sleep. So then at least I could go back to sleep. In hindsight, there's probably a little bit of insulin resistance going on with that, which I haven't had through this pregnancy. So I occasionally I'll wake up hungry, and it generally correlates with my stomach getting bigger, you know, a few days later because I've done some growing. But I haven't had to go and get a snack in the middle of the night. So it's
been amazing. Different. And so jumping forward, because I'm as part of this story, obviously we'll talk about how the second pregnancy happened and things like that. But I do remember when you got pregnant and we were in the protocol talking about it, and you were like, okay, my last pregnancy, I was getting really hungry. So like in the middle of the night, what are some of the snacks that I can have that are not going to be as insulin stimulating? So it's been good. It's good to hear that you haven't really needed those ideas. But yes, I think you're right. Often when we have dysregulated blood sugar and our insulin's not working as well as it should, sometimes we get a bit of a drop in the middle of the night. Between about 2 and 4 a.m. is really common. And this is not just for pregnant people. So if you're listening to this and you're not pregnant and you're like, hold on, I wake up between 2 and 4 a.m. quite often. This could be what's happening is blood sugar often drops about that time and your body doesn't want blood sugar to be low. So it releases adrenaline to bring your blood sugar back up. And of course, you wake up because it's not normal to be having adrenaline pumping around your body in the middle of the night. So then you wake up. You may not feel starving. So you did test, which is a really good sign. Okay, we need to, you know, go get food, bring your blood sugar back up. But if even if you don't, it's quite a good idea if you are waking up then to have something like, especially something like, I don't know, some salty nuts or crackers or something like that beside your bed, something that easy that you can get your hands on and eat and then go back to sleep. But if but a good way to preempt that, at least while you're kind of sorting this out, is to try and have a snack before, right before you go to bed and see if that resolves the issue. But yeah, really good that you haven't had to be using that as much this time.
Yeah, which is good. It's funny comparing the pregnancies again. So I'm much more physically active this time than I was last time. And I think that's because I made a really conscious effort to do something that would be sustainable through the pregnancy. So when I got pregnant with Henry, I was doing CrossFit. And there is a very, very tiny percentage of the population that can do CrossFit while they're pregnant. And even they're probably kidding themselves. So I stopped that at 8 weeks and I'm like, yeah, I'll do workouts at home. And I didn't do workouts at home. I'd walked a bit and I, you know, tried to keep relatively active, but, you know, I didn't really do any sort of significant strength training through the majority of that pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
And in hindsight, that was a really big miss because it took so long to get it back.
Right.
And I'm someone that's, you know, I've been in a gym since I was 16. So it's part of who I am. I really enjoy it. I really get a good kick out of it. And so, you know, it took me a year before I felt comfortable doing lunges again, just to get that in and around my pelvis. Because, you know, big babies and not exercising much means lots of weakness in that area. So
absolutely. And also just having that confidence in your pelvic floor and everything, as you said, around that pelvis. And interestingly, if you do want to understand a bit more about why pelvic floor strengthening and is important, not just for pregnant people, but also for everybody, we did a podcast with Caitlin Day, the vagina physio, a few episodes ago. I'll pop that in the show notes for today's one as well. But just, it is, do you think as well that there was a really, was it due to just say fatigue that you weren't feeling like exercising, or was it just that you were like setting yourself such a high bar that you couldn't meet that you then ended up just being like, oh, well, if I can't do that, I might as well not do anything at all?
It's two things. One, my iron was probably suboptimal going into Henry's pregnancy, which is much, much better this time around, which has just been night and day in terms of energy during the pregnancy. And the second is it's just my personality and just the way that I know I function. But I work best when I go to the gym and someone tells me what to do and I do it. And so the gym I'm at the moment is a weight-biased circuit training.
Great.
And so you're only going to do stuff for 40 seconds at a time and then they tell you to go to the next exercise. Now, like I said, I've been in gyms for, you know, since I was 16. So I could write myself my own periodized program that would be, you know, that would sit there and never get done, because I really just need to go there, have someone tell me what to do. I'll work hard and then I go home. I've got too many other things in my life where I've got to think and focus and drive myself. I've just found it's the one area where I just need to go and someone else tell me what to do. And then I get so much more out of it.
Yeah, and I think that's such a good self-awareness tool, is realizing those little things. And we shouldn't feel any kind of form of guilt around that. Like I have a personal trainer and I have an honors degree in exercise science, right? I know what I should be doing, but it's different, especially it's different when you have someone who can just push you that little bit more, right? Like, and the sessions, so we're in lockdown at the moment and I've still got her doing a session for me over FaceTime every week. And it's night and day, the difference between what weights I use when she's with me on FaceTime and what I use on my own. It's just that having that confidence, even though she's not physically there with me, having that confidence that she's like, no, you can, no, absolutely. 12 and a half, no way. You're up to the 15s today for those deadlifts. Like having someone to just be like, no, you can do that. We did it last week. We did it 2 weeks ago. And you're like, oh, yeah, okay, cool. No, we, okay, yep, that's good to know. And I think that's a great self-awareness. So there's so many different options out there for that, right? Like I'm thinking F45, is that one that you've tried or similar to what you do?
No, see, I'm one of those. If you're going to do CrossFit, do CrossFit. Don't do the cardio version of CrossFit. Yeah. That's just my personal opinion. Everyone to their own thing. And I left CrossFit because I did CrossFit for about 4 years. When I first started, I had a less stressful job and I really got a lot out of it and I really enjoyed it. And mm-hmm. it was sort of the area of my life where I was challenging myself. And then as my jobs got more involved and more stressful, my stress balance, I didn't have as much to put into CrossFit. So I would get, you know, those adrenal issues where you get tired and you get sick and you get injured and all of those things. And I just, when I pulled the plug, I just made the decision that it's not right for me anymore. It was great when I was doing it. And it's probably more of a young person's sport or someone that, you know, can balance that stress. But in terms of what I can tolerate, it's just too much for me to do that. And so I've just got a girls' gym, a ladies' gym in my area. And they use barbells and you use dumbbells and, you know, everyone's really pushing still and, you know, the weights are not what they were in CrossFit, but they're still good. But it's less intense and that's what I need. And it gives me the ability when I really want to push, I can push. And then the days that I, you know, can't push, that's okay. Cause I'm still, you know, middle of the pack with everyone. So it's just really worked for me. And especially going into this, second pregnancy, knowing that a lot of the trainers are pre and postnatal certified. And that, you know, there's other women that have gone through that gym and had their pregnancies and then come back afterwards and they've felt supported. And there's all those things that you can do to change up the exercises so you're making it good for yourself. So it was just, the right choice for me then. And whether that, you know, is the right choice for me again in another 4 years, it might be that I, you know, by then I need more of a challenge or whatever it is. But, it's just this pocket in time, this is the right thing for me going through this.
I think that's a really good thing to hit on is that one I want to pull out from that, what you're talking about is what I term the stress bucket. So when we think about how much or what our body can cope with in terms of the amount of stress that we're putting it under, we really need to think about the fact that we've only got a bucket. So imagine like just a 40 liter bucket, just a standard one that you'll find in your laundry or wash house. That's all you've got the capacity for, right? And the more things we put in there, the more full it's going to get. So as you said, when you started CrossFit, which is a very high intensity sport, so you're going to be filling your stress bucket up quite a lot with that. You had a low stress job, right? Like I imagine you could go to work and you could do your job and you could come home and it wasn't, you knew what you were doing and that was fine, right? You weren't, by doing those things, everything in your life, you weren't overfilling your stress bucket. But as soon as your job changed and became more stressful, suddenly what you were able to do before is now overflowing that stress bucket. And you're starting to see the ramifications that you did of low immunity, so getting sick all the time, getting injured. Maybe it was affecting your sleep. So you were either struggling to fall asleep or feeling really tired when you woke up. And I think that's a really good thing to realize is that it's just, hey, what was working for me maybe isn't now, and having the courage to make that change, which is often, especially in an environment like CrossFit, can really, they put a lot of pressure on you to not be quitters and not, you know, you can really feel like a failure, but actually you're not. You're just actually being very sensible and listening to your body and saying, actually, this isn't working for me at the moment. We're going to try something different. So I would encourage anyone else that may be feeling in the same space to assess what you're doing and going, hold on, maybe is my stress bucket overflowing? If it is, what could I remove? And maybe it's nothing to do with sport, maybe nothing to do with exercise, but it's the fact that you have now got a new young baby and or, you know, children at school, and you've suddenly taken on being chairman of the PTA, and you're like, whoa, I'm overwhelmed, right? This is too much, as well as everything else I've got going on. So how can I maybe extract myself from other things or get out of this? So it's really good to kind of take stock sometimes and just be like, right, okay, is this working for me? If not, what can we do about it? And then the second thing I really like is that, again, I totally agree with you that sometimes some of these things like your Barry's boot camps and your F45 might work for some people, but often their strength training, well, yeah, as you said, the kind of circuit cardio training dressed up as strength training, right? Where you're not actually really doing that progressive overload. And so when I talk to people about the benefits of strength training for resistance exercise, and they've had a history of doing these more circuit-based training, you just realize that you may not be getting the benefit from that you would if we really tailored that a bit more. So I think that's a good, a good point to bring up.
Great. So then, I had Henry. He was 9 pounds at 38 weeks, which is
big boy.
So got induced at 38 to try and see if we could have a natural pregnancy, a natural birth. And it just wasn't to be. So Henry came out the sunroof, which is fine. It's just what had to happen. And then it's you know, postpartum and working out what you're doing. And I think probably the thing I was least prepared for was not having enough milk. I think there's lots of things they prepare you for, but I think they try not to scare you. And they try not to add on to the things that you stress about, but there's really no preparation for the fact that you're not going to have enough milk to feed your baby and that you might not even really have enough to mix feed. So I took the medication and I did every single thing that I could and we mixed. And I look back, you know, I'm pumped 8 times a day in between feeds. I did every single thing you could possibly do. And
bought
so we mixed.
I bet you bought every supplement that you could find.
Everything,
on
the new pump, the new, all of it. And at 13 weeks, they sort of go through a change where they start to feed quicker. And I just went, nah, I'm not doing this for you anymore. I'm doing this for me. So I ended it then. And that was really, really hard because you want to give your child the best things that you can possibly give them. And, you know, breast milk is that, but not everyone can do it. And I think it's really hard to go into that unprepared. So I think, you know, like there's, like my sister had PCOS over milk supply. She's like in that rare category that has the world's greatest milk supply. And I, you know, I saw her go through her first pregnancy, and I saw her, you know, 8 months later, wafer thin because, you know, her son had sucked the life out of her. I said, yes, for once in my life, I'm going to be that person that gets that metabolic advantage. I'm going to have this thing, you know, when they say about 400 calories a day it is to produce enough milk for your child. This is going to be the one thing that's going to help me bounce back afterwards. It's going to be amazing. And I didn't get it. And it was really hard to deal with. So I think you got PCOS and you've got not a lot of breast tissue and not a lot of breast development during pregnancy, doesn't necessarily mean that you can't breastfeed, but just keep in the back of your head that it might not be smooth sailing. It might be tricky.
I did a podcast on this a while back. Again, I'll link it in the show notes for you. I'll just write myself a note for that. But there is a lot of research that people with PCOS, as you said, may not develop the breast tissue either at puberty, which possibly could have been the case for you, or also during pregnancy. And also too, if you have some high insulin, which we now notice that you do, because after we went through the protocol with you and found that out, that can also reduce your ability to produce enough breast milk as well. So as you said, it doesn't matter what fancy dancy pump you buy or what herbal supplement is supposed to be good for it, or how many lactation cakes someone makes for you. It's probably not going to change the fact that you just have not the breast tissue or the higher insulin that's going to allow you to do that. And I think that by not, so I know that in New Zealand, for example, there is such a huge emphasis on breast is best that there is not even any conversation about the fact that that might not work for you, right? And I think this is a massive disservice. And why I did that podcast is like, okay, so you might not be getting this from your midwife or your obstetrician or your antenatal group, but this is the actual reality. And even if it's just the fact of having a can of formula on hand and having some bottles already purchased, that it then means that you're not a stressed out mum with a crying infant because he or she can't get enough food. And you're then having to decide what formula you're going to buy, do your research on that, figure out of all the brands of the supermarket, which one's going to be the right one for you. And also then sending your partner out or you going out at 2 a.m. to buy that and all the bottles. So it's just that being a little bit aware and someone maybe making you aware that this, hey, this is a possibility, right? Like it likely won't happen, but just maybe let's just be prepared for this scenario.
Yeah.
So especially I think current research is really, if you're really not noticing any breast changes, so if you haven't had to go up bra size during pregnancy, if your breasts are quite tubular and separated, right? Again, you can Google image these things, just Google image. If you're like, what the hell is that? Separated, probably quite a wide part in the middle around your sternum and sort of nipples that point out to the side as opposed to straight ahead. Tubular, kind of think longer as opposed to more round. Again, Google it, you'll see some images. And if that's the case, chat to your midwife, chat to your obstetrician. They may then also put you in touch with a lactation specialist. So again, you might have those contacts readily at hand if and when you need them, as opposed to, you know, like crying and pulling your hair out at 3 a.m. because nothing's working. So yeah, I think that's a really good point to bring up, Tess. Thanks so much, because we talked about all the things we wanted to cover off in this podcast at the start, and that's one thing that I didn't think about that I really wanted to bring up. So thank you for bringing that up as well.
That's all right. That's all right. And then to, you know, just add a little bit of salt to the wound, my milk actually never fully dried up. So I didn't have much. It was just a few mils in each breast. But yeah, never. So Henry was about 2.5, not quite 2.5 when we fell pregnant again. And yeah, still had just the tiniest bit of milk in there, and they say, oh, you know, just gotta leave it, and like it's not going anywhere. It's not, yeah. There's nothing I'm doing that's making this come out here. Like there's nothing that makes 2 mils of milk stay in your boobs all the time. And even between, so November last year, we'd actually done another transfer. That the transfer was successful, but the pregnancy wasn't at 6 weeks that terminated. Even that wasn't enough to dry up that milk. So yeah, it's quite interesting.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Not enough to feed my baby, but it never really wanted to go away. So, be something I'll address more actively, when I'm finished having a go with this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And something else that we also identified during the protocol, right, is your thyroid, and that could be playing a role. So I know that I talked about this because you were asking me about it, and I said, if anyone's still getting or is getting any lactation when you're not nursing, not breastfeeding, get your prolactin checked, because prolactin should be, if it's high and you're not actively breastfeeding, it's probably an indicator. And then the second thing to get checked is your thyroid, because thyroid can cause an increase in prolactin. So prolactin is your breastfeeding hormone, and that can be the trigger. Yeah. So yeah, we've kind of talked about both things, but really having gone through now, you know, while we might not be at the end of fixing all of your symptoms, but we've sort of gone through and identified what likely might be the main drivers, right? And for you, that was definitely insulin. Yeah. And definitely thyroid that we picked up on, correct?
Yeah, thyroid's been in and out, hasn't been a constant, but yeah, generally when things have gone really out of whack, that's when the thyroid's gone really out of whack. So when things are progressing well, thyroid's been good. But yeah, when it's really, you could probably say those periods of time where I've had weight gain are probably where my thyroid's not really working very well. And then, yeah, periods of time where that's been really stable, and then that's probably where my thyroid's working well. So yeah, it's you can see the direct correlation.
Absolutely. And I think that's really also interesting to know as well that thyroid status does not stay static through your whole life. So one of the most common times that people, so it's hypothyroidism, low active, underactive thyroid is far more common in women. And a really common time for women to develop problems is postpartum after they've had a baby. And so it really shows that stress on the body, you know, because pregnancy is a massive stressor on the body. And it can really affect your thyroid, as can disrupted insulin and blood sugar can really affect your thyroid, as can nutrient status, right? And these are all three things that happen during pregnancy. There's a lot of stress on the body. Our insulin resistance gets worse if we have had some, because that's the way that our body gets nutrients to the baby, is by making us more insulin resistant. And then also the baby is, they're sucking all of the nutrients from us, right? Like in the nicest possible way. A baby is the cutest parasite you'll ever have in your body. And for good reason, they're going to get everything they need, and then you are going to be left over with what's left. And that is the definition of what a parasite does, right? It takes everything it needs from the host, and it leaves the host with whatever is left. So you're talking about with Henry, your iron was really low. I know your zinc was quite low with your thyroid as well, right? And potentially other nutrients that are really important for that thyroid to work properly, iodine, selenium, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why it's really critical to actually have a good prenatal vitamin, not just the shitty folic acid and iodine that they give you at the doctor, but actually one that contains all of the nutrients that you need. Not just to prevent neural tube defects, but to actually make sure that you have a optimal pregnancy where you have the nutrients that you need, not just enough to give the baby. So yeah, really, really critical, and stuff that starts to make sense when you know, I always think about people's health as like a Rubik's cube. And sometimes it can just be a matter of like, really, we can't just work on one thing. Just and it sorts itself out. There's often multiple things, and I think that's definitely the case for you, right?
And I think everyone says, oh, well, you know, after you've had the first one, your body might just know what to do and you might be fine. And that's not, you know, like sometimes that happens, but it's not, it doesn't just magically make your body not have, you know, these genetic markers anymore. And so I remember 2 weeks postpartum, I just lost a stack of weight, which is not losing weight. It's just, you know, I don't have a baby and I've been sweating for the last 2 weeks overnight, which not everyone tells you about the postpartum sweats, but just your body trying to get rid of fluid. And so I dropped like at 3/4 of the pregnancy weight. And then by 3 months postpartum, I'd put some of that back on, and which doesn't make sense because, you know, you're just constantly on the go and you're constantly doing things and you're really not eating that as often as you would like to. And that is really disheartening when you're like, yes, give me another thing where I'm gonna, you know, suddenly my body will just start working, and it doesn't. You might just be one of those, you know, people that it does, but I found it didn't. And I actually ended up convincing my GP to let me see an endocrinologist. And so about 9 months postpartum, actually went on to metformin to help with insulin resistance, just because we hadn't done it before. And I had the test results that said I would be eligible to do it. And I know not everybody has a good outcome with metformin. It takes a bit of work to get onto it and to get onto it at the full dose. So not everyone is keen on doing that. But for me, it was a game changer. It allowed me to be like a normal person. So it allowed me to, you know, not be perfect all the time and still be able to lose weight. Because it just wasn't budging on its own. You know, I'd managed to lose 3 kilos, and that was by, you know, super low carb, miserable life where you don't feel good, and you know, you've got a small baby, and you know, you're trying to do that, and it's just awful. This allowed me to do it in a much more managed way. And then I found it about 12 months postpartum, just, you know, sort of 5 or 6 kilos just fell off. It was just ready to fall off then.
Brilliant. That's good. Did you find, so you're saying it takes a bit of time. Is that for you, was the building up to help your gut get used to that level of metformin? So you kind of slowly increased the dose until you got up to,
Yeah, and
I mean,
even
the dose
then,
can.
once or twice I had to go back down on dose and slowly
Right.
go back up again. Had to cut out magnesium for a little while. I found that was interacting in a way I didn't want it to. And it probably took me 9 to 12 months to get the magnesium back in.
Yeah. And sometimes it can just be changing the form of magnesium as well. So, you know, magnesium, so most often if you haven't tried metformin before, the most common symptom of people is diarrhea and just this urgency to go to the bathroom, right? Feeling like you always need to be around a toilet in case you need to go. So and magnesium, especially magnesium citrate, the form of magnesium, also has that effect. So you put them together and you just get this really bad. But there are other forms of magnesium, like magnesium glycinate, which don't seem to have that effect for most people. So sometimes it can be just changing the form as well. But yeah, otherwise, realizing that sometimes metformin doesn't work for many people, but also sometimes it just can be changing the dose or changing the form to like a low release form, or even sometimes changing brand can make a big difference. So starting up, what did you end up on? Were you on 1500?
To 2000, I actually 2000 ended up
milligrams.
On. Yeah. And I found when I was on that dose, I couldn't do inositol at the same time. I found that was just giving me really low blood sugar after I would take that. So it was just managing how that was sort of working. But yeah, I found that to be really good for me. And then I found myself too scared to go off it again.
Yeah.
So I managed to get down actually below my pre-pregnancy weight, sort of heading towards what I would call a healthy BMI. And I was too scared to go off because I didn't want to go back to risking, you know, all these fluctuations all the time. And in the end, after I felt pregnant, I did go off it and all of that. But yeah, it's funny how you sort of get something that works and you get a bit scared to change it up. But
yeah, totally. And also, many people don't need to go off, right? Like metformin is kind of one of those drugs that's meant to be kind of long-term use. But I think that one of the interesting things that I've seen is that it doesn't always maintain its effect for some people. Some people tend to develop like a resistance to it after about 6 or 9 months. So if that's you listening to this as well, know that that's quite common. And again, it might be a matter of changing things up a little bit, changing brand, coming off, trying more, or like habit stacking. So building onto that, not only the metformin, but it might be that we just change your lifestyle and what you're eating as well, and that can then trigger that to work more effectively. So there's lots of ways and means we can do that. But it is, what I have seen really common.
Yeah.
So what, now that you're fully aware that insulin's not working properly and you've gone through all of those lifestyle changes, what have you noticed about your body now since you've made those changes to your lifestyle?
Just a bit more consistency. Things aren't swinging wildly out of control all the time. I can go 4 hours and get hungry, not hangry, not lightheaded, not, you know, snappy or anything like that. But, you know, my body's saying, okay, I'm ready for more food now. So much more consistent in that. And I think the more you can see, you really got to be objective about the things that are helping you and the things that aren't. You know, my husband's a dessert fiend. He loves dessert. It makes him happy, and that's what he wants. So he has dessert, and it just doesn't help me. I wake up in the morning starving because I've had you know a peak in my blood sugar, you know, just before I've gone to bed, and it just doesn't work for me. So I found that, just having that consistency, and then also just being able to pull in tools as I need it, because everyone's symptoms with PCOS, it's sort of a spectrum. And so some things that, you know, people are like, oh, I only need to tweak one or two things. Other people need to pull, you know, 5 or 6 strings. So like with this pregnancy now, I was finding that my weight was increasing faster than I was probably really comfortable with. And so I went, okay, well, what strings do I need to pull? And I'd started this infatuation with this, I think, dark chocolate that started with, you know, just a couple of pieces at night and was more than a couple of pieces at night. So, you know, I had to pull that back in, and And I'm actually tracking my food at the moment, which I have to be careful about because I try and win at tracking. And just as an example, like, you know, when I used to track in the past, I'd be like, oh, 1,800 calories, okay. Well, if 1,800 calories is good, then maybe 1,700 is better.
Right.
And I would always try and be under, and I would always feel better about being under, and maybe sometimes significantly under, than I would feel about being over. So I'm very conscious of my thought process at this time. I'm like, I need to hit this amount of nutrients for my baby and to make sure that it's healthy and to make sure that I'm getting enough protein in my day, and then the mix of, you know, carbs and fat I'm not too worried about because I know that the carbs I'm having is part of a meal and it's not going to be sitting on its own triggering insulin. So it's sort of, it's been quite a different approach to it, but I'm really conscious that if I start trying to win it again, then, you know, it's something I need to put away. But I use it more as the case of going, okay, well, this is roughly what I need to hit. I know this breakfast works out to this. I know this lunch works out to this. I know this dinner works out to this. I've put all these pieces together. I'm roughly in the right situation. I don't worry about weighing things every day.
Absolutely. And I think that's the thing is when you've got that, when you know what you can get away with, you've got way more flexibility, right? You don't have to live by these rigid diet rules and plans and stuff like that. You know that you've got quite a lot of flexibility in that day and in what you're eating. But yeah, I agree that sometimes for some people, tracking works really well. And just that being aware, and especially when, you know, you might be having some food aversions during pregnancy as well, which tends to hit more the protein foods. There is never a problem with beige foods in pregnancy. Like every pregnant woman that I've ever worked with, there is never a problem with having white bread or any other like potato or, you know, just refined carbohydrates. It's not a problem. It tends to be the protein sources that are really hard to get in. You just, like most people, either actively avoiding them or just really don't, just no desire to. Their body is either saying absolutely not, or I can probably eat it, but it's just not on my radar of what I'll feel like. So you sometimes have to work overtime to get that protein requirement in, right?
And again, I think that's a difference in my two pregnancies. So the first one, in the first trimester, I went off anything remotely sweet and meat. So even like pumpkin was too sweet.
Right.
And so it was bizarre. In that first trimester, all I wanted was something salty. And in the second trimester, all I wanted was chocolate, which I'm not really a chocolate fiend. Like 70% chocolate is a bit of a treat for me. So I'm not one of those people that would eat it during the day. So I would sit there and I would fantasize about chocolate for 45 minutes. And I'm like, I don't understand. This is not part of who I am. But I haven't had any of that this time. I've probably been a little bit more wanting things a little bit more salty, but I've been able to just add a little bit more salt to my food, and that's been enough. I haven't had to go. I haven't, you know, really wanted the hot chips, or I haven't really wanted, you know, all of the beige foods. I've been fine with what I have, and I think that's, I don't know, I didn't get any morning sickness, so I can't say for those people who are feeling particularly ordinary in the mornings, but. All day. But I just found for me this pregnancy, because I've been more consistent, because I'm not getting those spikes and lulls in my blood sugar, I'm just, and I think maybe I'm taking more magnesium this time. It seems to be helping just keep everything a bit more level.
And I think you're right. I mean, we know one of the main triggers for pregnancy nausea is low blood sugar, right? So if you've got good blood sugar control, good insulin control, more likely to have less nausea. Or if you can preempt that low blood sugar, so even I tell people in the first trimester, especially if they're getting nausea, to have something before they even get out of bed, right? Because often just that trigger of getting up and your cortisol rising drops your blood sugar and therefore can trigger that nausea. So all of those things make perfect sense about why better blood sugar management potentially leads to you feeling better during pregnancy as well. But one of the most fascinating things is actually how you got pregnant this time, right? Because you'd been through the second IVF and then we're working through in the protocol, and it was such a great story that I was like, I really want you to explain how that happened this time around.
Yeah, so we did another transfer in November and that was unsuccessful, and it was it just took forever for us to resolve the miscarriage. And sorry if this triggers anything for anyone. I had a clot that they said, oh yeah, that's clearing on its own, and it wasn't clearing on its own. So I ended up early Feb, I went in and got that all cleared up. So it was 9 weeks of on and off bleeding, which is a long time. So luckily I'd actually had an iron infusion before that transfer, because otherwise I would have been in a lot of trouble. Just bleeding.
Lots of blood. Yeah.
Really good. And so then I sort of, I can't remember exactly when I started the protocol. I think it was maybe April.
Yeah.
Something like that. And then I sort of, over time you accumulate skills and you know what works for your body and what doesn't. And I think going into the protocol, it sort of helped that I was probably 70% of the way there with a lot of things. It's just tweaking those last few things. So I can imagine it's quite overwhelming for people that are just sort of coming in, they don't know anything, but sort of coming in, I knew a lot of things and it was just putting the pieces in the right spot.
Yeah, but what I've realized about people with PCOS is that we are very well educated on the whole in terms of our own health, because we've had to be, right? Because we're not getting the answers from our doctor in most cases. And so we have done a lot of reading and tried a lot of things. And I actually ask through the questionnaire that I get you to go through to identify what's actually driving this in your PCOS, I now ask like how you would rate your knowledge around that. And then most people rate that they're like, yeah, my diet and exercise are really good most of the time, or even my diet and exercise are spot on, right? Like that is mostly what people rate. And I think that's really, you know, this is completely in opposition to what medical terms would be used around people with PCOS, and that they, you know, aren't managing their lifestyle. And I just think that's absolutely wrong. And my data shows it very, very clearly. But this is what I think is that also often we think, well, if I'm already doing all these things, then really what more can I learn, right? What can I, if I'm like, you know, for yourself, I'm already have been a CrossFitter in my life and I'm already doing, you know, I'm active and I'm doing resistance training and therefore I'm already eating really well. I'm not a chocoholic. I'm not eating McDonald's three times a day. So what more could I do, and what more could I learn that is going to have that much of a difference? And it's surprising. Small tweaks just make such a huge difference.
And because you've done so many things, making those tweaks is actually not that hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always like, oh no, I eat this and it doesn't make me feel good. But actually when your blood sugar is more consistent, you can actually eat those things. And because I always thought that I needed some sort of denser carb with most of my meals in order for it to feel like I had eaten and it digested and it didn't gurgle and make me feel uncomfortable. But the more consistent my blood sugar is, the more I can have, you know, an omelette for lunch and not really have a lot of carbs with it, and I'm okay with that. Or I might have an omelette for lunch with a mandarin, and that's enough, and it's not, you know. And you know, I'll have a snack between then and dinner, but it's not, I'm not sitting there going, oh, it's just not digesting. Like, it's actually fine. That's been sort of a bit of a surprise.
Sometimes, as I said before, it's that habit stacking. It's that we try lots of individual things and maybe they didn't work because they weren't in the right combination with the other parts of our lifestyle. So, you know, we might have tried changing diet and changing exercise, but it's that when you actually add the cumulative effect of all of those little changes, it's amazing how much they add up to and what that means. And again, it's coming back to that Rubik's Cube analogy, that if you imagine that, you know, you've done so much work on diet, but you've still only got one side of your Rubik's Cube that's all green, right? And the rest of it's all scrambled. And until we get that Rubik's Cube all working together, it doesn't make a difference, right? It doesn't make a difference if we've got one side correct. We actually need a lot of those different parts of our body working well together. So it could be that we've done a lot of work on our exercise and diet, but we've really neglected our sleep and our nutrient levels. And actually, when we work on those, they actually make a huge difference.
And for me, I actually found it was, so I'd been taking these herbs that help lower my testosterone. So it's got the licorice root and the white peony.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been taking that for a while. And then I got tonsillitis. And they're actually quite big tablets. And I was like, I'm just not going to take them for a few days. And I'm just going to see what happens. And if my skin breaks out, I'll take them again. But, you know, I just need a break from trying to get these things down my throat. And about 4 days later, I was like, there is a change in my cervical fluid. This is because my ovulations are very obvious. The symptoms are very, very obvious. I know when it's happening. And there's so few of them, and it's so different from, you know, what I normally have, is that I know what's happening. I was like, this is a bit strange. Let's just see where this goes. I won't go back on this. I'll just see what happens. And then, yeah, a few days later, you know, getting that egg white sort of consistency. And then I got the ovary sort of ping pain. And I went, I have ovulated. This is so bizarre. This is, you know, I'm 35 and this is ovulation number four, or natural ovulation number four in my entire life.
Yeah, wow.
And even then, I didn't think anything would happen because we'd had the four ovulations as part of the
clomid, assisted
reproduction. So I had done that and nothing had happened. So, and we were already on track to sort of do another transfer. So I went, well, that's, look, you know, I'll do a test. Came back negative. So I'll take the medication that I take to bring on a bleed. And normally you take that for 5 days and then, you know, 1 to 2 days later, you have a bleed. And sort of 3 to 4 days later, I had a bleed. I was like, this is a bit odd. And I'm sort of Googling. It's like, yeah, it's 1 to 2 days. It's like, oh, okay, this is a bit weird. And so I did another test and I'm like, yeah, okay. So we're pregnant. And then and my husband's like, that's not how we fall pregnant. Like, we go to the place and then the man that we've never met before goes between your legs and like shoots it in. Like, that's how we fall pregnant. We don't do it naturally. So it took him a little bit to get used to the concept, but yeah, this is what we were doing.
And this was real. So, this was happening. This was
Yeah.
And it was your fourth ovulation ever.
Ever.
And you were 35, which again is, everyone says once you're over 35, like you're, you know, reduced risk. So this is pretty much first try, first ovulation, over 35. And that was it. And yes, but not, right? Like, I honestly, it is amazing how many people that I see, like, you can listen back through the podcast, Sarah, whose podcast is about, this is going to test my podcast knowledge, but I think podcast 9, first, had never had a period.
Yeah.
First ovulation ever, right? Like, and she was like, yes, and I still haven't got my period, Started feeling a bit weird to test, positive. And she was like, whoa, how does that happen? I've never even had a period. So, I mean, you know, like, as in she's had like pill bleeds and stuff, but at that time had never had a period. So it is incredible. And also too, I think, it just shows that as well, age can't maybe not, it is definitely is a factor, but it is certainly not a hard and fast rule, especially we're thinking with PCOS. Now there's very early evidence, absolutely not conclusive, but potentially our fertility is a little bit more extended than people without PCOS, just because we have so many more follicles or baby eggs in many cases, right? So again, we cannot generalize across all people with PCOS or anything like that, but it is potentially a good news story for us that is better as, you know, at 35 plus than maybe some of our other friends without PCOS. So a great story, but not necessarily an exception to the rule.
For me, it was just, I never, ever in my entire life thought I would fall pregnant naturally. Like, it just wasn't, you know, people say, oh, you never know, your body might just start working, which I have to say, my body didn't just start working. Like, a lot of work and effort went into being in the situation that I was at, that my body could do it.
Yes.
Which,
as you said before, if it was going to start working naturally, it would have worked after you'd had Henry, right? Like, it would have started ovulating again. And that's, but for you, you really had to work on bringing down that insulin, putting together all of those parts of your Rubik's cube to bring that down for your hormones to be at a level where your body could ovulate. And then it did, right? Mm-hmm. And then it will again, once you've had this baby and when you're wanting to. That can happen again. But it really, as you said, it's like, it's not just, it's it really does take understanding what's driving, what's stopping your body from ovulating. It's not, you know, you weren't missing any sexual organs. They found that out when they went and did the I really struggle to say that.
Laparoscopy.
Laparoscopy. Where they did that. And so we know that it is hormonal. And this is the case for people with PCOS that don't have any other missing sexual organs or other things that could be affecting them from getting pregnant. It's purely a hormonal thing that we can fix through changing various things in most cases.
Yeah. And then because we'd had the loss late last year, like pretty much as soon as I found out, I called my obstetrician and I said, look, I'd like some blood tests and when can we book in for an early scan and all of that. And he was great. So we did a progesterone. He actually said, oh, we'll do two progesterone tests 2 days apart. Mm-hmm. And the first one came back fine. And mm-hmm. then the second one had dropped significantly and was just above the sort of the risk range. And so we went on to the progesterone pessaries and I kept that up until about 10 weeks in, when I felt like everything was really stable and I probably didn't have, I think they did another test sort of a week later and then I didn't do any more tests after that because sometimes it's hard to convince your doctor to do that. Like everything's fine. But I didn't have any more bleeding and I didn't have the 6 week, I didn't have the 6 week bleeding like I did with Henry or with the one I lost. So I was really glad that I had that support there. And
yeah, absolutely. And having a practitioner that is really open to using that. And this is something that I find so hard sometimes is convincing women's doctors to prescribe micronized progesterone to help them keep good progesterone levels during pregnancy. Because it's not a standard treatment, there is a lot of conflicting information. There isn't a systematic review that says can absolutely people that have low, you know, progesterone below a certain level should, you know, progesterone supplement does actually help. There are some studies, but then there are also some conflicting studies as well. And so, yeah, I distinctly remember having a conversation with one of our protocolers doctors here in New Zealand, who was in a small town I won't name because it's probably too obvious. But I called him and I said, hey, could we have a chat about her progesterone levels and looking at getting her onto some micronized progesterone? And he was like, no, I'm not having this conversation with you. It is not, there is no guidelines for that. It's not evidence-based. And I was like, yeah, I 100% agree with you that the evidence isn't clear that. But I was like, there are some studies here. I flick them through to him an email. And I was like, look, these are the ones where I totally agree the recommendation across the board for all people having, progesterone doesn't support that. But if it's below this level, these studies show that that actually could help. And he was like, no, but okay, yeah, that's fine. There's, you know, a couple of studies, but you can, if you're looking for anything, you can pretty much find a study that supports your point of view, right? And it's true, you can. And I said, okay, yeah, I totally get there and I know where you're coming from, but what is the risk of doing this, right? Like what is the risk if we, given that we're, you know, giving her natural progesterone, so it's just topping up her body's levels. So long as we keep within the normal reference range of that, what is the risk of doing that? And he was like, well, we just don't know. And I was like, yeah, I know that's the case, but just if her body was producing that, would we see an issue with it? And he was like, well, no. And I was like, yeah, exactly. So why, what is the risk? And that's, I think, the conversation. And eventually ended up that he wasn't willing to do that. So she went to talk to someone else and had a conversation with them and they were willing to give it a go. But it is, it really comes down to that practitioner. But I think the really interesting thing is that most fertility clinics will do this out of a course of action, right? And you experience that. So if fertility clinics are doing this, then why should women that are not going through fertility treatment have less access to that treatment than those that are? And that's what I find really, really hard to grapple with. So,
Or those that are having repeated miscarriages, but not, you know, the doctors won't do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I would say that in most cases, progesterone levels are fine, but Well, most cases in all women, but I do find that in most people that I work with, when we do test their progesterone, it's either, you know, the first test is not good, or as you did, we keep getting it tested because it's not a one-off test. Progesterone can be really good and then it can suddenly drop down. And that's where, especially someone like you that had a history of that early bleeding at 6 weeks and then a miscarriage, it really supports that use of progesterone to try and keep that uterine lining intact. Yeah, very hard to sometimes find a practitioner that will support you in that. But if you do, I think that it is absolute gold dust. And please share those practitioners, because I think that the world needs to know more about them. Yeah. But yeah, just be aware that if they're not doing that for you, you can ask for it. And in most cases, for example, a progesterone test, or sometimes in most countries, you can pay out of pocket to get it yourself. Like, for example, in Australia, I know it's about $30 to get a progesterone test if you order it online. New Zealand, it's about the same, for about $40, and the US, it's $19. So they can be quite a cost effective thing if you do need to do it yourself. But in most cases, your doctor should be relatively supportive of this, especially if you've had any prior miscarriages or any prior, irregular bleeding during that first trimester. So that's you now at 22 weeks.
22 weeks, yeah. So this pregnancy has been way easier. Despite the fact that I'm my stomach is actually much bigger. Like, when I was looking at photos last night, and I probably look about 4 to 6 weeks further along, despite being, I think I'm about a kilo heavier than what I started Henry's pregnancy at. So there's lots more baby and just slightly less of me this time around.
And that's often the case as well with second and third babies as well, or going through further along than that, just because also those abdominal walls can sometimes be a little bit more stretched, and so it can sometimes look like a large bump, even though it's not necessarily. Must be very interesting to see the difference between.
It is, and it's like physically it's so good, but mentally it has been much, much more challenging, because I've gone through a pregnancy and I know that magically out the other side, you know, the weight doesn't fall off, and not that the weight is be all and end all, but it's, you know, it's been such a big part of my life and the way I think and all of that. It's been really difficult, you know, seeing the weight climb at faster than what all these graphs say it should, despite the fact that I create 90th percentile babies. And so that really, I've really been working on that, and really been focusing on enjoying this pregnancy, and not focusing on that side of stuff. But it is really difficult, because it's sort of this blissful naivety with the first one going, well, surely it's, you know, like, I don't know what I'm in for. It could be easy, but, and it's the same as any other time in my life I've tried to lose weight. It wasn't easy.
Yeah. And I think it's always just hard as well to see your body change, even when you know that there's a reason for that, is when you've had a history of unexplained weight gain. It is very hard to disassociate that brain from, okay, I know this is changing, and yes, my clothes are feeling tighter, but there is a different reason for that as well. And no matter how logical that is, it's very, very, very hard to be rational about that.
Yeah, and especially, like, you know, I've got a couple of people I know who are pregnant at the same time, and one of them, bless her soul, looks like she's just had a large lunch and is still fitting into her normal clothes at about the same gestation. And you know, she's a beautiful human being, and I'm really happy for her, but I kind of just hate her a little bit at the same time.
Yeah.
Because that's not how I grow my babies. I grow them big, and so I have to keep reminding myself that, you know, this is the genetics that I've got, and this is how I produce them. And some people produce small babies, and then they come out and they fill them full of milk and they get nice and fat then, you know, and mine just get nice and fat on the inside. And that's okay. It's just, you know, and you have good days and bad days. And I'm finding, further I'm getting into the pregnancy, that the easier it is when you don't just feel fat anymore at the end of the first trimester and you actually sort of start to feel pregnant. It's been better, but that's been the surprising part, that, you know, physically it's actually been a lot easier, but mentally a lot more challenging. So.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good thing to talk about, because so many people just expect you to be like, you know, over the moon that your body's changing, but it actually can be really hard, especially if you've had a long history of dieting and body image struggles and weight struggles. That it doesn't, it's not like that leaves you. It still often is there, and it is quite hard to come to terms with that. So I think that's really good to hear other people talking about that, because there'll be so many women in the same boat as you going, yeah. I know a patient, I just spoke to her last Friday, exactly the same issue. And we talked about all the things you could do. We were talking about for her, because I know it's worked really well for other patients, but just embracing the, you know, like the clothes that are fitting you better. So instead of just trying to keep fitting all your clothes, even though they're feeling really tight, just because you're, you know, people say, oh, don't buy too many maternity clothes. You know, this is a waste of money. Try to fit what you've got. But feeling uncomfortable, and that's only going to make things worse, right? Like, go out, find those stretchy jeans, find those, I mean, we were talking about with her, those rib knit dresses and stuff that are like luckily in fashion at the moment. Brilliant, right? Stretch with you, look really good. So all of those things that you could do to make yourself feel better can be really helpful. So don't fight against those just because people say you shouldn't buy more. If you're feeling uncomfortable, do it.
Yeah. And the other side is all the well-meaning people that like to tell you how big your bump is. And they say, oh, you're so big. And I, as a female in this society, you know, going through what I go through, the last thing you want to be described at is as big or large or round or popping out or any of those really well-meaning terms that for some reason just you can't accept them as compliments. So I've sort of got into the habit of saying, you know, glowing or, you know, look well, or just correcting them a little bit and just saying,
yeah,
I know it's all meant in with, you know, beautiful intent, but, you know, no one likes to be told they're big. You don't tell an obese person they're big, because that would be rude and uncaring. You know, and they're like, oh, but you're pregnant, you know, you're supposed to be. Like, yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't, yeah. It still hits the same way. So
yeah, absolutely. It's that still that years of social conditioning around that, and being, you know, being very aware of like your body doesn't make it any easier. So I think that's really good, because also like a lot of us just say it without even thinking. And so it's good to hear, you know, for those of us that haven't been pregnant, that, oh, okay, yes, right. There was a, you know, here are the really good words.
Glowing is great.
Glowing is great. Yeah.
You're looking really well. Also just spot on. Mm-hmm. Or yes, oh gee, your bump looks beautiful, you know. Mm-hmm. Those are all great phrases. Mm-hmm. Because you can't misconstrue them, you can't get upset about them, because they're not triggering in any way.
So. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's very good. So anything that you would like to share in terms of last sort of thoughts of wisdom with people listening here that you can think of that we haven't already talked about?
Oh, I don't think so. I think I've downloaded my entire brain, but just keep trying different things. Like with me, with the, you know, I always thought I had to get the testosterone down and down and down. She stopped taking those herbs, and it allowed it, you know, mine to peak to ovulate. So just not something I'd really thought of from that perspective before. So just keep trying things, keep stacking those habits, and you never know, you might just spontaneously ovulate at 35. Who knows?
Yeah, but I think that's the thing, is there's always, your body wants to ovulate. Your body really wants to, behind survival, you know, reproduction is the next most basic physiological driver that we have. And so sometimes giving your body the tools it needs to do that. And it's not always obvious. Sometimes it's going to really, really take a long time to, just to get, as you said, get the Rubik's Cube, kind of all of those habits that finally make it work. But don't give up, and don't think there's nothing more that can be done. Sometimes it can just be talking to the right person, or just that one thing or two things or three things that you haven't done together that make all the difference.
Yeah.
So good advice. Well, thank you so much, Tess. It's so great to talk to you. I mean, an incredible story and so many different facets of it that I think will resonate with so many people. So thank you so much for your generosity and sharing your story and being so vulnerable with us.
Thanks for having me. It's look, if there's one thing that someone takes out of this and it makes it easier for them to go through their journey, then it's all been worth it.
So that's all for today. Remember that if you want personal help with your PCOS, then the best place for that is our PCOS Protocol Program. This is not some generic PDF that you get sent. This is the first week we understand, identify what's driving your PCOS, and then you get given the most important changes for you. So, and I'm there with you the whole way, answering questions, being there with you weekly on the video calls. Further personalizing this for you and identifying if there's anything else that might be going on for you. I mean, every week we talk with different women about different symptoms, and you know, that might lead them to get an endometriosis diagnosis or find out that they've got small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And that's what you can understand from hearing these stories from women, is about that often it's there's connecting issues that when we actually look at them holistically, we figure out what's actually happening for them. So, if you want more information about that, then there is a link in the show notes, or you can head to thepcosnutritionist.com/thepcosprotocol, or just hit program from the main menu. And if you've got any questions, then please don't hesitate to email us. We're hello@thepcosnutritionist.com. Bye for now. Now, stand by for our disclaimer. The information contained in this podcast has been prepared for the purpose of providing information, including about the PCOS Nutritionist products and services, and is designed to support clients' overall wellness. It is not intended to provide medical advice or designed to rectify, treat, or cure any specific medical conditions or diseases. Nothing stated or shared in our podcast is intended to be and must not be taken to be medical advice. Please seek the advice of professionals as appropriate regarding the evaluation of any specific information, opinion, advice, or content contained in our podcast.